Welcome to the Bali Ocean Secrets podcast, the podcast where we, myself, Juliet, and my other half, Matt, speak to the spearfishers, business people, expats, and locals of Bali and tell the story of our journey there. So here we are with episode 2. And this one's all about some of the amazing businesses and business owners we met while we were on our Bali adventure. Bali jungle trekking was one of them. Our guide took us on an incredible day out from Lovina in the very north of the island to visit 7 waterfalls, the Blue Lagoon, and through some of the most isolated jungle and mountain areas we've ever seen. A mix of walking, swimming, and scooting got us there, and we picked the longest trek on offer. That was not my idea, but it turned out to be a great idea. We were literally climbing up and down cliff faces and through rivers, where Matt even lost his sunglasses trying to help me across.
We're going to 7 waterfall and 1 blue lagoon. So the first one is we call Chamada waterfall, and then the Dali waterfall, Changin waterfall. And then after that, we're driving a scooter to go to the next one, to going to Aling Aling waterfall. After that, we're doing, what is that called? Swing at the blue lagoon, yeah. And then to go to the next one, we're not really excited there because it's a bit busy. And then going to the last one to get lunch right there. That's it. And then get the coconut desert, right?
That lunch by the biggest waterfall was pretty special. I love nasi goreng. It's this local rice dish made with chicken and egg and satay. And it's beautiful. And we had it for our lunch there. And then our guide told us a little bit about why he loves his job.
It's really fun to meet new people. They're crazy when they're jumping at the 15 meters maybe. They do triple flip. They do dive at the 15 meters. Yeah, that's a crazy I am.
No doubt it was a tricky time in Bali during COVID. Businesses completely stopped and so much of the economy is based on tourism. A lot of the locals went back to their family rice fields and worked there.
Yeah, you know, when the COVID coming is, we are really struggling. So we're looking at another side job, but it's a bit difficult also. So, but actually for me, my brother have small business. So I help my brother at home to get a little bit money.
If you want to do this yourself, here's what our guide said.
Get the Bali jungle trekking to book.
We also spoke with Edward Dangerfield, who runs Breathwork Bali, a breathwork school and coaching center based just outside Canggu. Their work is incredible, and you can hear more about it in another podcast we produced, Finding Feel Good, and in our next episode, episode 3, about building in Bali. Edward told us a little about his work schedule. Now he's scaled and is still scaling the business.
So I now, as of this month, like I work 8 hours a week, like official work. And then the rest of it's just managing projects and overseeing and mentoring and teaching, but all free. So now in the afternoons, I'm like, financially, I've paid for myself. Everything's supported. I've got money to invest in other things. Yeah, the practitioner training, 1 a year, 3 months, pays for a lot of things. And that's how it's set up. So these are my needs. Once my needs are met, what do I want to do with my creative time? So by midday, I'm like, I'm done. Like taking my son out for morning movement practice. So I had a surf, taking my son out for breakfast, gone to work for 2 hours. And then at midday, I'm like, now what? I'm going to go to the sauna for an hour. And then I'm going to spend the afternoon doing whatever the fuck I want. So now I've got spaciousness for looking at more of these like passion projects from a space of like actual wealth, but not like extreme wealth, but just like, it's just flowing.
And we also met Mary.
Hi, I'm Mary, and I'm founder of the ethical jewelry brand Guardians of the Sun. It means that we care not only how the jewelry is made, but also where the materials come from that we use. So we've set up our own supply chains for ethical gold with 23 indigenous Dayak women, and they pan the gold for us by hand. And we buy from them at a premium price, so they receive more for the gold than they would otherwise. And in exchange, they don't use any mercury or cyanide, and they do not deforest, and there's no child labor either.
Her business really is very special, and it's run from a super special location, an incredibly peaceful villa off the beaten track on the island with its own pool and these beautiful trees. We actually had some bespoke jewelry made by her while we were there, and she told us about why her business is so special.
a lot of, let me explain to you how the jewelry that we sell is quite different from a lot of the jewelry that you'll find on the island. So many jewelers, they use casting for their jewelry, which means that they use wax, they carve out the design, and then they cast it. So basically they can make as many copies as they want. We don't do that. So every piece that we have is made by hand. So we get like the metal grain, we melt that, we shape it, we form it, and then it goes around the gemstones or the diamonds. So it's really made one by one. A lot of the stones that we use, I buy the stones myself and I get like that are, you know, there's only one stone like that. So we cannot make like a master mold. And then most of our clients, what they love the most is the custom birthstone jewelry that we sell and the custom engagement rings. So clients will come to us. They'll be like, okay, so my birthstone is a sapphire and my husband was born in May. So that's an emerald. And then I have like two kids, June and July. And then I also have a dog who was born in November. So then we'll make a ring with the birthstones of every single person in their family. Yesterday, I met up with a couple who wants to get married tomorrow. They're like, we want to get an engagement ring and wedding bands. And just hearing like, look, we're getting married quite suddenly, but I've known for like years that if ever I was going to get an engagement ring or wedding band, it would be from you guys. And just to hear that, because, you know, you have like so many followers on Instagram, you know, you don't really interact with them. You don't know what Gardens of the Sun or what your brand means to them. And just to hear that someone's been following you for years and that they knew all that time, if they were to get married, it would be with one of your rings. That's like, oh.
She talked us through the ethics behind her business.
So you have Fairtrade Gold and Fairmined Gold. They do something similar. So Fairmined is mercury-free. Fairtrade isn't necessarily mercury-free. And they certify like the gold as being Fairtrade or Fairmined. We've set this up as like small business, and the people that have set this up are like larger companies that have been in business for, I don't know, decades. So we've tried to do something similar so that we could source the gold locally and we know where it's from, because even if we would get like recycled gold, you still don't know where it was originally from or how it was originally mined. And if we would get fair trade gold or fair mined gold, we would have to get it from Peru or Colombia. So we'd still have to get it from the other side of the world and then import it into Indonesia. I was like, no, I want to work with the people that are near us. I would like to actually make a difference in these people's lives and not just buy from something that's already set up. I want to change what we're doing and how we're doing it.
And how she got started.
So I first started Gardens of the Sun when I was still working as a sustainability consultant. Making jewelry and creating jewelry, designing jewelry, that was just something I did for fun in the evenings and on the weekends. I was like, no, I want to keep my job as a sustainability consultant because I'm actually doing something good. And with jewelry, I was just creating something beautiful. For me, it was only when I decided, look, I'm going to use jewelry to do something good, that I quit my day job and I could move anywhere I wanted to. So Bali was.
And the pros and cons of running her business out of Bali.
It's a dream on the outside and it can be so frustrating day to day. I think you're dealing with a lot of delays, a lot of quality control issues. So you really have to stay on top of things a lot more than when you would be living and producing or manufacturing in a Western country. But the good side is I'm sitting in an office with a pool, with beautiful view. On the right behind me is a mango tree that's actually fruiting at the moment. So we've got some fresh mangoes. Behind me, there are frangipani trees and there are little flowers floating in the pool. Then a little bit behind that, just outside of the fence, we have banana trees. We have tree papaya trees, three different kinds, actually. So we get three different kinds of papayas. You can hear birds and just there's actually the cafe next door. They have a lot of animals as well. So you can hear their birds and their animals sometimes. It's spacious and it's outside. It's not like we're not in a box. We're not sitting in like a square space with, you know, maybe a few small windows. Everything's, there's a lot of windows, a lot of light, a lot of air. So this morning I actually surfed. I surf on a stand-up paddleboard. So I caught a few waves this morning. Then tomorrow morning I'm going to play Ultimate Frisbee. And then after that I'm dancing. So I do contact improv, which is like a combination of meditation and acrobatics, cuddling. So you're basically just rolling on the floor, constantly touching with people. You don't have particular dance moves or anything that you follow. You basically just roll around, play like monkeys. And it's my favorite time of the week. I also do pole dancing, salsa dancing.
Mary has big goals for the future.
Running an ethical jewelry business myself, that's too small. I want to get bigger than this. So what I'm working on is selling the gold that we get to other jewelers that are also working in Bali or in Indonesia. Yeah, I also hope to set up more solid supply chains for ethical diamonds. That looks like complete traceability, knowing exactly like who cut the diamond, who found the diamond. Just having like the names of the miner. Like imagine that you buy a ring and you have a picture of the person who mined your diamond, the person who cut your diamond, the person who made your ring. Like for me, that I would love to create even more transparency. There's still a lot of smuggling of diamonds going from one country into another because it's basically saying this diamond is from this country. And this country is not involved in violent conflict, doesn't have like any rebel movements, so it's good to go. But then often what happens is it gets another country where there is conflict, where there is armed conflict, where there is violent conflict. They will smuggle the diamonds from that country into the country that is exports the diamonds as certified conflict-free. It just gets exported together with those conflict-free diamonds. There are so many ways that blood diamonds or conflict diamonds are still entering the supply chains. You know, they've got most of it. So let's say there's like maybe 75 to 90% less conflict diamonds like on the market, but there are still conflict diamonds.
Serious food for thought as to where we get our jewelry from. Later in the trip, we met Lorna Watson, who runs Stella Bags, and has a similar vision for knowing where our products come from. This time, though, it's beautiful handmade handbags. Lorna told us how she first ended up in Bali.
I first came here because of yoga, and I used to go to a place in Thailand like two or three times a year for yoga. And through that community, I came to Bali because my American teachers were running... You didn't even have retreats in those days. You went somewhere for yoga and you stayed there for a month at a time. So I came here for one of those months and just totally fell in love with it. And my background, I did a degree in applied arts and I'm a trained goldsmith. So high level craftsmanship is in my DNA. So when I first came to Bali, everywhere you turned, especially up in the north, central north around Ubud, you just saw craftspeople everywhere you turned making really incredibly high-level products. It was all tradition because you didn't have this sort of Western influx in Bali that you have now. Maybe there were one or two businesses that were exporting, but it was all local trade. They were making for one another. They were selling within Bali and Indonesia. Things would take weeks, if not months, to make one item. And then over the years, I just saw that decline massively because of mass production in neighboring territories. And so they were then being asked to make the same thing, in inverted commas, a similar type of thing, make it faster, make it cheaper, and then not getting paid properly for that. And that's how it just became totally unsustainable for most artisans here to maintain a livelihood through traditional craftsmanship. So I kind of got pulled into it through just my passion. And I was introduced to this family of basket weavers in East Bali. And it was more from a research perspective. I was curious. I wanted to understand why was it dying off? Where had people gone? And I was introduced to this family in East Bali. And that's when I met Wayan, who's one of our head artisans. And he explained to me the process, you know, coming from my background, I was just blown away by the materiality and their wisdom of this natural plant fiber that just grows, you know, prolifically in the foothills of where they live. And then he explained to me the time it takes to create this and what they were making baskets at that point. They weren't making bags. And this basically coincided with Mount Agung erupting. Oh, wow. And Wayan's immediate family lived up in one of the villages closest to Mount Agung. So they were all evacuated and they were in a refugee center for about 6 months, and they had no work. They had left their livestock behind. They'd left all of their means to make any living behind, which was mainly at that time agriculture and sure. livestock. And they were in this center, refugee center, with nothing to do all day, no means to make any money. So I thought, well, this is a perfect opportunity. Give them something they know, because every Balinese knows how to weave. They all learn to weave when they're children, to make the Chanang Sari offerings for ceremonies. They learn to weave a mat or the roof above their heads or the mat that they sleep on. So that's when I realized, well, if we're going to make this work, we have to bring them and their skills to the forefront of it, pay them properly, number one, but also acknowledge them properly. So everything we make has a disc with this unique code on it. Every bag, every item that we make has its own unique code. And when you as a customer purchase something and you put the code into our website, it connects you back to the craftsperson who made it, tells you the story of the skills that are being regenerated. And so now you meet any of our artisans and they're prouder than anyone you're going to meet on this island.
So there's a real ethics and history behind Stella. And Lorna knew she was ready for a change from the high-powered fashion world in the UK.
I was a creative director for a brand at that point, and we would joke that we were working on four seasons in one day, because you would literally be selling the season. The next season was already developed, all the marketing had been done, everything was ready to go. The season after that was already in development, and the season after that you were beginning to research. I mean, it was crazy the amount of development that was expected of you and the pace of development, and the level of waste was just shocking. And I, you know, as a yogi and someone that, you know, had this parallel life of that was relatively conscious, it just felt like they didn't align. And I knew that I was going to move into something that was much more meaningful.
But she's always had an interest in sustainability outside of Britain.
I also had a number of diversions in my career, I guess, that didn't make that much sense at the time. For example, I went to Sudan and I ran a project with the British Council in a university in Sudan to help people sort of understand how to work with natural materials around them, because they didn't have enough money to buy expensive materials. I worked on an artisan project in South India. You know, so there were little things that happened along the way that at the time felt a little bit random when you looked at the CV. But, you know, of course, it all makes sense now.
So for Lorna, her career was always headed in this direction. She talked us through the logistics behind the business and its integration with Balinese communities around the island.
So we have seven communities now. Everyone in Bali already has even rudimentary weaving skills. Even the men, they all know how to weave. And actually, our atta bags are mainly done by men, interestingly. The community's about 70% male. There's very sort of deep level of indigenous wisdom rooted in this material. It's very primal. It's this sort of inherent wisdom about the land. You know, we have a take, make and replace approach to what we do. So anything we take out of the ground, we replant and we put back in again. So within the communities, we're not just regenerating the skill of weaving, we're regenerating the agricultural side of it and the level of engagement. And then we also have an apprenticeship program that we bring in new communities. And everyone has to go through a one-month training program with us that we pay for. So it's a kind of re-education program. And then they reach a certain point where they're then able to produce for us. But then we also have a training program for young apprentices that we bring in as well. So we've got two parallel programs running. It's a very exciting measure of the impact that's happening within community here. that actually there's an acknowledgement and that high level of engagement where we've now got communities approaching us and asking us if they can get involved.
And she told us a little bit about the importance of transparency and sourcing products with clarity on where they've come from.
And then we're also working on a new model of, it's taking the process of what we already have and bringing it to the forefront of the business. So the Stella from the word go was built for me on transparency. So we knew who we were working with. We knew where we were sourcing our materials and that we were sourcing responsibly. And we know every stage of the process because it's made. We commission the work, we follow the process of how it's all being made. We've got all of that information at our fingertips, which most businesses don't have. They don't have that level of visibility. What we're planning to do is have a QR code at different stages of the unboxing. So this is still ultimately, for me, this is where the real value lies, because QR codes are quite throwaway as much as they are of huge value. They're also now, because of the pandemic, the perception of them is very much a sort of transitory tool. You know, I think even with ocean plastic, if it's recycled and you're reusing the material, then you're doing something way more responsible than putting it into landfill and starting all over again to produce a new plastics.
Their bags are genuinely beautiful and so much more meaningful than the average bag. You can find them online and in stores.
They can find us on our website, which is thisisstellar.com. Obviously, Instagram, which is also thisisstellar. And we're in stores. We're in Selfridges in London. We're also in Fenwick's in London. And we just ran a series of really fun activations. And I landed in London and our CEO came to London for the day. He lives in Sussex and came to meet me for the day. And we were meeting the buyer in Selfridges. So we said, okay, let's meet at the brand on the shop floor. And I got there first and I was standing there having a moment. I'm like, you know, we made it to Selfridges. This is like awesome. And I'm standing there. And out of the corner of my eye, this very chic woman and her daughter walked up, grabbed one of our bags. And she was like, I love this bag so much. And she sort of grabbed it and hugged it and said, I want to have this bag. It was an authentic customer who'd just seen our bags.
We also spoke to spearfisher and freedive instructor Sam, who started his own business when he came to Bali.
I didn't really plan coming to Bali in the first place. I actually just got a job offer here and then came over to work for the school. And it was actually my first actual job teaching freediving. Before I had like done things with friends and stuff, but my first ever like actual official job teaching freediving was the first job in Bali. I did that for 2 years and it was just fun. You know, you're traveling, you come to a place, it's sunny, it's nice. I'd been traveling before that quite a lot. So it was just a thing that I'd been on, like a traveling type of vibe. But then I ended up staying in Bali a lot longer. I think just after 2 years when I'd been working for the other school, I did reach a point where I was like something needs to happen or change or something. I wasn't really happy to keep just working for someone else. So I saw that it was quite straightforward and easy to run a business after I'd been working for one for 2 years and seeing what their strengths and weaknesses were. I was like, well, I think I can do this and maybe do it better and diss the school that I worked for. But it was just an experience for me to learn how to run a freediving school.
He told us about his motivation to set up the business.
I didn't think I could do anything super spectacular. It's more just that I wanted to be the boss. It was nothing that was particularly... I just wanted to be the boss. You know, I didn't want to work for someone else anymore. I wanted to make a school. And the whole idea of it was so I just wanted to freedive. I wanted to have the time to train and go spearfishing. When I was working for someone else, I had to work all the time just to make ends meet. And I wanted to get to the point where I was the person running a school, employing other people, so I could do my own training and I like teaching, but when you do it all the time, every day, it does become tiring. So I wanted to just do little bits of teaching and have another person who would take teaching and work for me sometimes.
And gave us some insight into the logistics behind setting up a business in Bali.
You have a choice between doing a foreign investment business or a local business. If you do a local business, you would just be partnering with a local and you wouldn't own the business. And then if you do a foreign investment business, then you basically can own the business as a Westerner. You have to have quite a lot of capital up front to put into that as an investment. Does make it difficult for small businesses to set up in Bali. To be honest, to begin with, I just was teaching out of my bedroom. I had a little balcony outside the back of my house and I didn't even rent the whole building. I was renting one room, teaching people out of the back of the balcony, and just had my own gear and a website and everything. And I just used to work really hard to make people have a really amazing experience so that they wouldn't give me a dodgy review for not having an actual proper premises. And they would have to use my toilet in my bedroom when it was toilet break or whatever. But that didn't last for very long. When I started getting everything going properly, I then rented a room downstairs to make for a classroom. So it was a much bigger room that was dedicated to being a classroom. And then before long, I decided it was a good idea to just rent the whole building. And it's really important. What's really important in Bali is it's about relationships. You've got to have good relationships with the people that you're working with. Like I lived in that building for a while and I developed a relationship with the landlord. And then we started talking way before I actually set up the freediving school. We talked about the idea and we kind of developed a trust, and we very much trust each other, you know, and we've helped each other out with different things. And it's really important to have good relationships with the village and the people around you and the locals. You can't neglect that. If you neglect just fitting in around you, then you'll end up just getting spat out somehow.
Of course, we have our very own boat in Bali now. And if you want to get in touch with Gus, the captain of Bali Ocean Secrets, and take a spearfishing trip or a sunset cruise with him, you can go to Bali Ocean Secrets on Instagram. Keep listening for episode 3 of Bali Ocean Secrets. We'll be talking to some expats about building their homes in Bali and the housing options we have there. Make sure you follow and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. And a huge thanks to all of our guests this time: Bali Jungle Trekking, Mary, Edward, Lorna, and Sam.